On this 27th day of February 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, General History, chapter 18, description of the Varnashram Dharma, text number 15. Bimbrachin munirvasaha. Bimbrachin munirvasa. Kalpina chadanam param. Chaktam na danda patrabhyam. Anyat kinchid anapadi. If the sannyasi desires to wear something besides a mere kopina, he may use another cloth around his waist and hips to cover the coping. Otherwise, if there is no emergency, he should not accept anything besides his danda and water pot. Purport. A sannyasi attracted to material possessions will spoil his worship of Lord Krishna. We'll go on and see. That's the whole purport. Text 16. Drishtipurtam nyasetpadam vastrapurtam pibejanam satyapurtam vadedvacham manakpurtam samachadet. A saintly person should only step or place his foot on the ground after verifying with his eyes that there are no living creatures, such as insects, who might be injured by his foot. He should drink only water. He should only drink water after filtering it through a portion of his cloth, and he should only speak words that possess the purity of truth. Similarly, he should only perform an activity that his mind has carefully ascertained to be pure. Purport. While walking, a saintly person is careful not to kill any tiny creatures on the ground. Similarly, he filters his drinking water through cloth to avoid swallowing small creatures living within the water. Speaking untruths simply for sense gratification is detrimental to devotional service and should be avoided. Speaking impersonal philosophy and glorifying the sense gratification of the material world, even that found in the heavenly planets, contaminates the heart and must be avoided by those desiring perfection in the loving service of the Lord. By serious consideration, one can understand that any activity other than devotional service to Lord Krishna has no ultimate value. Therefore, one should exclusively engage in the purified activities of Krishna consciousness. Om Ajnana Tavarandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So the first verse we read is illustrative of the extreme renunciation of the traditional sannyasi. Sannyas means total nyas, total renunciation of all vestiges of sense gratification or even comfort. It's a real sannyasi is something called yatis. Yatis means those who are always striving, you know, at every moment to maintain on that pure renounced platform. And that's indeed what sannyas really means. It's practically inconceivable in today's world that someone can live like that. We take the perfect example of the sannyasis, the Goswamis in Vrindavan, and what was their standard of external standard of life. Practically no comforts, even to the point of eating and sleeping and defending in the sense of having a home. They renounced that. You know, they were eating practically nothing, sleeping practically an hour and a half, if that. And they went from tree to tree. They didn't even plant themselves under a tree and make it their place. They went from one tree to another, as was pointed out, to avoid even the vestige of I and mine in terms of my dwelling, you see. So this is the extreme renunciation that is standard for traditional sannyas. Now, the thing about the Goswamis, first of all, they're not, you know, this is the ancient age here. You know, this Krishna speaking this 5,000 years ago, and it's the end of Dwapara Yuga. And so he's explaining a standard that is practically unmet by anybody, even if they're serious about sannyas outside of ISKCON, I'm talking about, or outside of Vaishnava philosophy. Sannyas is there throughout. The jnanis, the yogis, they're meant to, you know, take this kind of level of renunciation. But this, within 500 years, 500 years ago is, you know, recorded history. Here you have the standard of sannyas, and it was shown not only by the six Goswamis, but by others who came before and after them also. We read, there's this book I read by one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, O.B.L. Kapoor, or Adi Keshava Das, his name is. And he wrote this book about the Babaji's of Vrindavan. And we know that there are some Babaji's who don't really meet the standard, and Prabhupada is very adamant about not associating with them. But these were Babaji's who were real Babaji's. You know, Babaji's is more or less what is being described here. The Babaji standard is just minimal dress, chanting constantly, living in, like one fellow lived in a tree, in a hollowed out tree, and chanting constantly and a high level of realization. And these were all stories of amazing things that happened, you know. And these Babaji's all lived after the Goswamis. They gathered in Vrindavan. Lord Chaitanya pioneered Vrindavan. You know, he resurrected it, and then it was fully resurrected as the place of pilgrimage and Krishna's place of Leela, stans, by the Goswamis. But then there was a whole generations of Babaji's who went there. Jagannath Das Babaji is the most famous that we know of, but there were many others too, genuine Babaji's, who you could say they're meeting this standard. You know, they have practically nothing, just a little water pot. They go around Madhukari. Madhukari means to act like a bee. A bee is a Madhukari, it makes honey. And so they go to flower. You know, they don't live in one spot. They have the hive, but they go around all day, go from flower to flower. So the sannyasis, the real Babaji's, they'll go from maybe house to house, you know, so that they're not dependent on any one person. And not take too much from each one, take a little from each, and in this way sustain the life. You know, and then sleep sometimes in a tree, sometimes here or there, you know. We'll have questions later. So it's possible. But it's only possible to get this kind of standard of renunciation when there is very strong, strong Krishna consciousness. It's possible to renounce at a very high level anything resembling comfort or sense gratification, when the nectar of Krishna consciousness is constantly flowing in your heart, and you're feeling satisfied and delighted in bliss, you know, and you couldn't, you know, any kind of sense gratification is just anathema. It means that you're worse than indifferent. It's repulsive. You know, because you know that it'll break your Krishna consciousness. So this is the standard in our line. This is the line that we're in. You know, this is the line. Srila Prabhupada showed that all the great acharyas, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, even though he was a householder, he showed this extreme renunciation as well, internally. Externally, he may not have been carrying the danda in the water pot, but he had the same level of renunciation. So the second verse we read has to do with the inner mood of the sannyasi in relation to how he relates to the world, and very, very careful not to injure anyone. You know, in other words, the genuine Vaishnava sannyasi, his heart melts, you know, with compassion for every living being, and not just even human beings. And we have the perfect example, and if you give me this, you know, this story is always worth repeating, the story of Narada Muni and the hunter. Because the same idea is there. So Narada Muni, he travels everywhere. And he is a Shaktyavesh avatar, meaning that he is empowered by the Lord with a certain Shakti. And his Shakti is Bhakti Shakti, meaning that anyone he comes in contact with, he can bestow bhakti. He gives them just what they need. It doesn't stay very long, just a few minutes. He was cursed. Who was he cursed by again? To not be able to stay. Daksha, right. That's another story. So he accepted that curse, just like Prabhupada said, he was cursed by his disciples' parents, that he also couldn't stay anywhere. identify me. So anyway, so he goes here and there, and he's always appearing in the pages of Bhagavatam and elsewhere. So he came across, he's wandering in the forest, and suddenly he sees this injured animal, you know, a little squirrel or some rabbit or something, and he's writhing in pain. He's got an arrow, you know, he's not dead, but he's writhing in pain and dying there. He keeps going, and there's some other animal like that, and there's all these little animals half-killed and writhing in pain, and it's just devastating for him. He's feeling compassion, empathy with these animals, and he feels horrible. How did this happen? So then he comes across the hunter who made it happen. And this hunter is a very low personality, dark, you know, this is his profession, hunting. And so Narada Muni approaches him. Now, he was respectful, you know. I forget if he bowed down right away, but he was respectful to Narada Muni. And he says, great sage, nice to see you in my forest. So Narada immediately appealed to, was it you who, you know, half killed these animals? And the hunter said, yes, I was taught to do that by my father. This is what we do, you know. And I guess the reason is to keep them fresh, so you have a whole day of, you know, killing, and then they don't die right away, whatever. So that's the story. So he says, yes, this is what I was trained to do. So Narada said, oh, look, you're a hunter, okay, but do me one favor. Just kill them outright. When you shoot a rabbit, kill the rabbit outright. Don't prolong the agony and have them suffer so much. So the hunter protested, this is what I was trained to do. This is our technique. So Narada Muni, by his mystic power, he gave a vision to the hunter of all these animals after death waiting to get him. You know, this is what happens. It's described in the third canto. Everyone you've tormented in your life is waiting in their next body, and they're going to torment you on the way to your meeting with Yamaraj, where you get more torment. So the hunter saw this vision, and he was chastened. he was shocked, you know, frightened. First of all, he saw the real power of Narada Muni, and he saw that he was headed toward a lot of suffering. So he appealed to Narada and said, how can I be relieved from the suffering? He says, I can give you the method, you know, but you have to do what I say. So the hunter said, okay. So the first thing, break your bow. So this is the critical point. He had to have faith. So the hunter says, well, how will I support myself? He said, don't worry, I'll supply everything. You break your bow, and then I'll teach you. So he broke his bow. And Narada Muni taught him Krishna consciousness. He says, now you simply chant Hare Krishna. Give everything you own away to the Brahmins and the Vaishnavas. Set up in a hut somewhere with your wife. And just chant Hare Krishna, be a Paka Vaishnava, and I'll supply everything. Everything will come to you, don't worry. So he started chanting. He became purified. You know, he was purified by the association, by surrender, and by following the instructions. So now when he goes off, you know, and then he comes back a little while later, say a month later, and he comes with Angira or Agastya, I forget, one of the big Munis. What was it? Parvat Muni. So he's coming there, and they're approaching this hut of the hunter. And the hunter, former hunter, he sees his Gurudev approaching at a distance. So immediately he gets up, and he's about to offer the dandavats, but before he does so, he sweeps the path. So there's no little bugs, ants, or, you know, anything on there. He sweeps the path, and he offers his dandavats, you know. And he gets up, and he's ecstatic to see Narada Muni. And so Parvat Muni, so Narada Muni says, just see the transformation of this hunter. Before, he was half killing animals and was completely indifferent to the suffering of these sentient beings, you know, not just a bug, obviously, you know. But now he won't even kill an ant. He won't even hurt an ant. This is the power of the Vaishnava Dharma and the purification of Krishna's holy name in the process. So this is what's being mentioned here in terms of he's always careful that he doesn't place his foot. You know, just like we're walking around here. You know, I'm sitting down and sometimes bugs get in, especially in the summer. We have a whole parade, right? There's always some bug who gets in, or he lives here. And they get on the floor. And the devotees are going around, and if they notice it, oh, okay, and get a piece of paper or something, take the bug outside. You know, even though, you know, philosophically speaking, it's very auspicious that that bug, rather than be eaten by a bird or something, will be crushed under the foot of a Vaishnav. Still, the Vaishnav does not want to be responsible for this bug breaking his the cycle. The idea is that each living entity in each body has a certain term to work out their specific karma. And if you kill them untimely, then that disrupts the process. They have to come back again in that body. And you've caused suffering, and so you have to suffer. The precision with which the law of karma works, sometimes we forget that. And the normal people, they don't even know that it exists. But every single thing that you do is taken into account. There's an accounting. And there's this, you know, in the Vedic culture, there's this understanding that there's so many unknowing sins that you perform. And it's often talked about in terms of these, killing these little bugs. You have to light the fire. You have to step in from here to there. And people who aren't just sensitive, and who is, you know, you're killing bugs here and there. You turn the fire on, there's some mosquito in there, and boom. You know, well, let's not call a mosquito. Mosquitoes are aggressive. But just some innocent, you know, spider. And zip, he's gone. You caused it. That goes into your karmic record. And so people don't realize, what about the the gross sins of animal slaughter, illicit sex, etc. But even the little things that we do that impinge on others' consciousness or cause pain to others, that's in our karmic record, and we have to pay for it. There's no free lunch. So therefore, the part of Krishna consciousness, which you learn about in the near the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, which is to how to work in this world, how to live in this world without incurring any karma, and how to get rid of the karma that you've already got, is an essential part of our philosophy. And it's for people who are a little intelligent and understanding how the world works, it's invaluable. It's invaluable. Just that part of it, which is just preliminary, to work in what is called naishkarmya, without incurring any so-called good or so-called bad karma. You see. And at the same time, to burn off previous karmic activities, good and bad. This is what the activities of Krishna consciousness does. And this word sannyas, I was thinking about is it the seventh chapter? I think it's the seventh. Mayi karmani sarvani sannyasyadyatma chetasya nirashyena mamo bhubha yudhyasarvakatantraha. This word sannyas, this is one of the nice, really nice verses of the Bible, kind of sums things up. Mayi sarvani karmani, he's talking about activity. Right? Bhakti is activity. Mahi sarvanikama sunyasyadhyatma chetasa. So to give up the fruits of all your activity to me. This is right. Mahi sarvanikarmani sunyas renunciation. Adhyatma chetasa. And to be spiritually situated, always thinking of Krishna within and without. Okay. What is it? Mahi sarvanikarma sunyasyadhyatma chetasa. To have no hope, no aspirations for anything material, and have no sense of false proprietorship. Be free of false ego, characterized by material desires and the sense of possession. And yudhyasva vigatadvara. For Arjuna was fighting. For us, it's some other duty. Perform your duty without fever. In other words, without becoming discouraged or lazy. Vigatadvara, without the fever of false ego. So this sums up. And this is what our practical bhakti is all about. You know, now, what activities to perform that give the fruits to Krishna, and how to come to the point, of course, of remembering Krishna always as we work, that's an essential part of the training. We're not just training up to be karma yogis, work hard all day and then give some of the fruits to Krishna. That's an important part of preliminary bhakti. But if we want to really advance in devotional service, we want to come to the point of constant remembrance of Krishna. So this renunciation is central, this theme of going against the grain of this world. This world is saturated. This modern world, this Kali Yuga, the modern civilization, is saturated with acts of sense gratification and inducements for more sense gratification, gross and subtle, and the devices that they produce, the technology, simply increases the varieties of sense gratification that you can dream about and you can enjoy. The electronics, you know. 30 years ago, if you were to describe the kind of electronics and the kind of things you can do, GPS, the iPod, iPad, the computers, all of this stuff, people would think it's magic. It's a dream. It can't happen. I mean, I remember I was just going back trying to read, which I couldn't read, these 100 megabyte zip disks. Remember those things? Those were old, I remember. Zip drive, oh, that was big, you know. What's 100 megabytes now? You know, it's chump change, you know. But in those days, oh, I'll get all my stuff, you know, recorded on here. The amount of information at your fingertips that you can access and record and manipulate is just unbelievable. But what's the central theme of all of that? What is the bottom line on that? This is part of the problem today. I've thought about it. You become like God, you know. One of the main things about God is that he knows everything. Right, he's omniscient. So you can know so many things and have access to so much knowledge and manipulate that knowledge. You know, and in this way influence others by the thousands. This is a false sense of power that you have. You know, when you're unplugged, you know, you're at the point of death or in those last months before death, what good is all of that information you've got on your hard drive? Or that you experience during your life. It's all what's up here, what your consciousness is that counts. Where your heart is, you know, and who knows what images you've seen. The fact that today, whatever you can imagine, you can produce an image with Photoshop and all this other manipulative stuff they have, is unprecedented. You know, it used to be you could describe it, and you know, you can make a mental image, but that's a whole different ballgame now. Now you can see it, you can hear it, you know, and that's very, very powerful. And still, the modes of nature are working, so somebody in the mode of passionate ignorance creates some image and some sound that then enters your mind, you're affected by that. You're associating with that person's madness, actually. And that's where you're at. And the real world, so-called real world, which we know is also just a shadow, becomes pale in comparison. You know, and so that's the world we live in. You know, and so to push back against that and to say no, you shouldn't do everything that you can do. You shouldn't let your senses do everything that you can do, that they can do, that they can experience. Because that will cause you great suffering soon and especially over time. So the sannyasis, they embody the principle of pushing back, you know, the exact opposite of this. You know, even to the point of enough clothes and food, you know. I mean, what does it mean to go around Madhikara? You're not controlling your diet very well. You're hoping that you're getting some wholesome food there. You know, I mean, this is a very high level of renunciation. Now, in the modern sannyas, as exemplified by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his disciples, headed by Srila Prabhupada, was different. First of all, this idea that we had in the last verse, if you want to have a greater cloth, yes, you know, they don't just walk around with kopan. You know, we don't just see that's the Babaji thing. You'll see that sometimes. But for sannyas, for preaching, for traveling, not just in the forest, but city to city, all over the world, if possible, for preaching, then, you know, there's a little different aspect. The inner renunciation is meant to be the same. But there's the famous picture of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wearing the coat. You know, and there's Srila Prabhupada, the Paramahansa on Lufthansa, this poem by Hayagriva, you know, the airborne, you know, Parivrajakacharya. Parivrajakacharya literally means walking everywhere. Well, why walking if you can fly and get, you know, or take the train? So realizing the essence of it, the renunciation is there, the realization is there, but the ability to reach thousands or even millions through technology, yes, that's called Yukta Vairagya. That's real Vairagya. More important than this nyas, you know, which is literally giving up, which is important, but even more important is the inner mood, Vairagya. There's raga in the bad sense, not raganuga, but raga is basically just attachments, you know, of all things. We're meant to give it up. Vita raga bhaya krodha. You can't give up the fear and the anger unless you give up the raga, the attachment. That's why it's always first. Vita raga bhaya krodha. Because with the raga, with the strong attachment comes the fear and the anger at those who are trying to take it away, or anger at God or providence. Why me? You know, you become angry. You're fearful you'll lose it. It's threatened. You do lose it. You can see how the mind gets completely taken away. So right, how many times does Krishna say in the Gita, "Vita raga bhaya krodha"? You know, at least 5-6 times. So, but Vairagya is an ideal. And what's the standard? Lord Rupa Goswami has given us anasaktasya vishayan yataham upayunjataha niyabandha krishna sambandhe yuktam vairagya muchyate. So, without being attached to the object of the senses, but using the objects where appropriate in the service of Krishna. In this way, not becoming attached to the objects, but becoming attached to Krishna. Nirbandha Krishna Sambandhe, Yuktam Vairagya. This is called Yukta Vairagya. It means detachment in yoga, you know, and through yoga. Other kinds of Vairagya are not firm, are not deep. That's why they're called Palgu. Palgu means weak Vairagya. And this is the exemplars of the weak Vairagya are the Mayavadis. Their sannyas, their external standard is much greater than ours, is much more extreme. You know, they're not allowed to have, you know, nice prasadam. It's maya. Glubjamins, forget it. You know, that's total maya. That's a fall down for them, you know. But glubjamins offered to Krishna with love and devotion and taken in the spirit of devotion, you know, or in a big contest we used to have. That's Yukta Vairagya. That's part of bhakti, right? So what to speak of, you know, it's just because they don't have Krishna. So they have to try to suppress. So the verse for them is Prapanchikatiya buddhya hari sambandhi vastunak mumukshubi parityago vairagyam palgukatyate. So parityaga. Now parityaga means literally giving up everything you can. You know. Forget about yukta vairagya, using things, giving up as much as you can. So, but prapanchikatiya buddhya hari sambandhi vastunak. Even those things related to hari, such as the deity, the holy name, the prasadam, the temples, the devotees, they see as material. Everything is all material. It's a material world. You know, they don't make distinction between an ordinary stone and the marble statue or deity of Krishna, which we know isn't really material. You know? So that's a hellish mentality. So, mumukshubi parityaga. They want mukti. They ardently want mukti. Devotees ultimately don't care about mukti. Right? They want bhakti. But they want mukti, they want liberation, so that everything is material. And this is called Pogla Vairagya. Now, Prabhupada tells a nice analogy for this. The Pogla River. Have you heard of this before, the Pogla River? There's a river in India called the Pogla River, which during the hot season dries up. A lot of rivers do that. This is called the Pogla. So it dries up, and there's no water in there. But the riverbank is still there. And if you put your hand a little deep in there, you'll feel the water, the moisture. Makes sense, right? So similarly, these Mayavadis, they're like the Pogu River. Means that externally they seem to be renounced, but you leave a little bit in their heart and there's so many desires in there. And that's why it's very hard to maintain that level of renunciation. And they'll come down, you know, and have all kinds of welfare activities or something like that. Or even gross, you know, activities. Because the juice isn't there. Just from studying Vedanta, You know, Vedanta ultimately culminates in bhakti. But if you just study Vedanta Sutra, if that's all the only book we had, we'd have a hard time. You know, without the commentary, the juice. We need to have the Bhagavatam, the natural commentary. So, the theme here is purity, really purity. And that's another central theme of our Dharma. Everything is really purification. It's all meant for purification. All of our tapasya is meant for purification. Tapo divyam putra kayena sattvam shudyed. It's meant for purification. The hearing and chanting is meant to purify. And when you purify the heart, genuinely, what awakens is pure bhakti. That's what's really there. It's not that it's just impersonal. You know, there's something there that's now covered by all this dross, all of this dirt, cheto darpana marjanam. It needs to be purified. The heart, the consciousness, the mind needs to be purified so you see who you really are. And who is that? It's the eternal servant of Krishna. You see your sarup, jivera sarupoi Krishna era nityadas. And you also see Krishna. It comes to mind this other nice description about purification based on hearing and chanting. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati apparently would quote this verse. This is the last in what I like to call the Krishna Katashtaka in the 12th canto. So I won't go through the whole thing, but just a summary. He says there that those who properly hear and chant about the powerful activities, qualities, and names of the Lord, Krishna enters the heart. You know, he's already there, but he enters it means he manifests there, and he purifies all of the sinful reactions, all of the anarthas, all of the ashubha, the inauspicious things. Just as the sun rising dissipates the darkness, or a powerful wind will get rid of the fog. So those words which glorify Krishna have this tremendous purifying power. But other words are simply false and useless and contaminating. And then he has this wonderful description of the tadeva satyam tadohaiva mangalam tadeva punyam bhagavad gunoriyam tadeva ramyam ruchirang navang navang tadeva shasrang manaso mahotsavam tadeva shokar navashoshanang nanang yadittam ashoka yashonagiyate. Sorry, I couldn't resist the Sanskrit. So he says those words which glorify uttama shloka, you know, they're beautiful shlokas. I mean, the most perfect sound vibrations in the world are those which glorify Krishna, his name and fame, like that. So this uttama shloka sounds, what is the quality? So it says, tadeva satyam, it's true. Here's where truth resides. Tadeva satyam, tadohaiva mangalam, and is certainly the most auspicious to hear. It brings piety. You become pious. We should want to be pious. We should want to become saints, you know. Not some, you know, the Christian saints. That's good, you know, but really, that's the ideal. Santas. The same way. So, punyam bhagavad gunodiyam. And it gives rise to the qualities of Bhagavan. We have 50 of those qualities. Of the first 50. You have to read the Nectar of Devotion to see. There are all these good qualities. Truthfulness, cleanliness, you know, skill in speaking, all of these things. So these qualities arise within you to the degree that human beings can have them. You become godly. So Bhagavad Gita, tadeva ramyam, very delightful, ruchiram, tasty, and ever fresh. You know, where is that? Those words that are ever fresh? Who wants to read yesterday's newspaper? You know, so but these words are ever fresh. Gita you can read every day, Bhagavatam we read every day, get new realization. Tadeva shashrang manaso mahotsavam, and it is, these words are an eternal festival for the mind. Manaso mahotsavam. They dry up the ocean of lamentation in this world. So much pain, suffering. You know, North Africa, people are dying. You know, South Africa, everywhere. You know, there's so much suffering going on. But the Sankirtan movement can lift this veil of suffering. But you actually have to take part. So, shokarnava shoshanangdanad yadutamashna. So he goes on like that. You know, the other words are like a pilgrimage of crows. They're the same as me. So then he gets to the last verse. What's the result of actually seriously hearing and chanting? Constant remembrance. Constant remembrance of the lotus feet of Krishna. And this is the verse I'll share with you. Maybe we'll have some discussion. Oh, it's getting late, sorry. So he says, Avismati Shridapada Padmayo Chinotya Badrani Chashantanodi Satvasya Shuddhim Padamatma Bhaktim Jnanam Chavigyana Viraga Yuktam. So this is the verse that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati would quote. So this constant remembrance of Krishna's lotus feet, which is the result of this proper hearing and chanting, destroys all abhadras, all inauspicious things in the heart, and bestows sham. Sham is good fortune. That's why Shiva is called Shankara, he who makes good fortune. So sham. Tanoti. It purifies one's existence. Sattvasya shuddhim. And bestows padamatma bhakti, devotional service to the Supreme Soul, Krishna. Accompanied by jnana, knowledge, vijnana, realized knowledge, and virakti, detachment. The perfect verse for today. So I'm sorry I went over. Any quick question or comment? Yes, Prabhu.
So it seems like if you, say, step on an insect or something and they have to come back and take that insect life over again, I was under the impression that all suffering was caused by karmic reactions, but this seems to imply that they didn't deserve to be stepped on and now they have to come back and suffer extra that they didn't deserve.
Well, there's two things going on. One is that in a higher sense, there's no accidents. You were meant to step on the bug, and the bug was meant to die at that time. And so, what's the problem? But when you're an agent of the karma like that, and it's an ego thing, in other words, you're stepping, your very all your activities is selfishly motivated, the ordinary person, right? Then you're implicated in that. Because to carry that logic to the final conclusion, we know that abortion is a horrible, horrible thing, right? The Prabhupada said several times that those who take part in the abortion, whether the mother, the doctor, or the facilitator, or whatever, they all have to take birth and never see the light of day for so many births and be aborted themselves. You know, the famous cow man. Right? The former cow that was slaughtered is now slaughtering the man who slaughtered him in the form of a cow. So I said, well, what's the problem then? In other words, the babies who are getting aborted were former abortionists. They're getting their just desserts. So why is there any karmic reaction for those who are doing the abortion? Because it's being done for false ego. It's being done selfishly. Krishna talks about this in the 18th chapter. It's all, you'll kill. Yes, you're going to kill some of your guru and all the people who you regard dear. But you, there's no reaction for you. Because you're not doing it for false ego, you're doing it on my order. So the idea is that, yes, there's a karmic fate there. But if you're the agent of it and you're doing it egotistically, you're implicated in the whole thing. And that's how the web just stays tight like that. This is the big banyan tree. So the idea is that, how can we act in such? How can we live in such a way that we're not implicated in karma? This is like stage one of bhakti, and that is to every step we take is a step for Krishna. Every breath we take is a breath for Krishna, and therefore the inevitable harm that we have to do to this world, because we're also killing out. We don't avoid every insect. We're cutting down weeds or whatever. So that is burned up. There's no karmic reaction, provided we're always working for Krishna. And that's why the value of nice karma, working in that way.
But what I don't understand is this whole idea of if an animal dies untimely when they're not supposed to die, which I don't understand how that works anyway according to karma, but if an animal dies an untimely death, then they have to come back and take that body over again.
To complete the course in that body before they go on to the next body.
But that seems to imply that not all suffering is caused by karmic reactions, that some suffering in the material world is caused just randomly, and that we didn't deserve it, but it just happened because it just happened. And now we have to suffer extra.
Well, that's the way it's described, that you've intervened. You've intervened in this, this is what Prabhupada said, you've intervened in this animal's life, and now they have to... You've disrupted their smooth moving up the scale, and therefore that's a sin. Now, how to untangle that? How does that work with the difference between fate and free will? How can we intervene? Isn't everything locked in? That's a classic question which we don't have time to get into right now. But maybe over breakfast we can deal with it.
But if a bird eats an insect, then we would say that that insect died a timely death. But if a human kills an insect, and we say, oh, that insect died an untimely death. So why is it if a human kills an insect, then we say, oh, they have to take it?
Because we have the opportunity to read this philosophy and to engage in, you know, to first of all avoid killing insects as far as possible, who are not attacking us like mosquitoes. And Prabhupada said, if they attack, you can kill them. They do attack. And we have responsibility, you know. The lion is not getting any karma for killing the gazelle or whatever he kills, you know. That's part of his nature and that's natural. But we will, because we don't have to eat the gazelles, you know. So that also extends to even things we do by accident, because we also have, you know, the overall ability to think about our activities, to avoid doing things, and to work in such a way that we're always working for Krishna, so there's no karma. Anyway, we can discuss it later. We're not going to be able to finish it now, and it's too late. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.